There is absolutely no question whatsoever that the most important single intellectual influence on Marx was Hegel. And the development of Hegel's thought, Hegel was older, of course, the previous generation, cannot be understood at all without understanding the impact of the French Revolution. In that sense, therefore, in an indirect intellectual sense, it's important for Marx's formation. But it's the direct bit that concerns us more here. Now, just let me run through, and I apologise to people who are familiar with this material, not being too elementary, a few elementary facts. The Great Revolution was the classic bourgeois revolution. More so than its English predecessor, particularly in terms of ideas, because the English Revolution, the Scottish Revolution occurred much earlier, 100 years earlier. More so than the American Revolution, again, a little earlier. We need to look at the central contradictions, therefore, of bourgeois revolutions, very briefly. 1789, slogans, liberty, equality, fraternity. The old order, remember, had been based on, not liberty, but an authoritarian monarchy. Not equality, but legal inequality. Legal inequality of rank, you know, the whole question of what you could be tried for, punishments and so on, determined by rank, status, all the rest of it. Legal privileges for the aristocracy and precious little fraternity. Now, therefore, the whole grandiose notion, splendid slogans, still appear on the coins, when they were fresh, in the upheaval, massive upheaval of 1789, destroyed the old regime very, very easily. The old regime was rotten. So it looked impressive. So rotten was it that a quite small kick at the door caused the building to fall in. You know, it is a fact that on the 14th of July 1789, when a crowd variously estimated at 5,000 to 15,000, you know, depending on who you want to follow on the thing, stormed the Bastille, centre, a symbol of state authority, and incidentally a quite impressive fortification. At that moment, there were no less than 30,000 regular troops, troops of the regular French, Royal French Army in and around Paris. In terms of, you know, if the regime had had any viability at all, no question, that crowd would have been scattered in short order. In fact, the army disintegrated. Central symptom of a real and truly profound revolutionary situation. The problem, therefore, for the new rulers was not actually mainly the question of the old order, the émigrés. You know, they'd nipped across the Rhine in the courts of petty German states, intrigues and so on. They made a great deal out of that, but that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was to consolidate a new bourgeois regime in which liberty is interpreted as you are free, you know, as Anatole France wrote much later on, you are free, perfectly free. The rich as well as the poor are forbidden to sleep under the bridges, the same bridges in Paris, right? You have legal equality. Equality doesn't mean, actually, you're going to get as much as me, you must be daft. No, no, it means that actually we are both subject to the same law, and that's all it means, right? Similarly, liberty means the right of suitably eligible people to participate in the governmental process. What suitably qualified people meant depended on your precise political tendency. We'll dispose of that in a couple of sentences in a moment, but it's the conception that is important. I mean, you know, we can't have, of course we believe in representative government, but the decision-making process must be confined to those who one can reasonably suppose are in a position by way of education, of leisure, which means they've got money, and so on, to intelligently take part. Hence the argument about who is allowed to vote, and so on, and so forth. All the rest of it. In other words, the expectations of the revolution, the ferment of ideas, liberty, equality, fraternity, being interpreted by the mass of the urban poor in Paris, Marseille, and so on, as meaning a new world, a turnover, the whole thing's turned over, it's new, it's fresh, and so on. In reality, the actual beneficiaries of the revolution, the bourgeois classes, with one important qualification. I'm talking about ideas, but we have to remember, ideas are themselves derivatory. There was one fundamental change in 1789, subsequently endorsed, but it occurred then, which could not be reversed. That was the effective destruction of the old agrarian order, and the creation of a very large class of small property owners, of peasants. A very large class. Part of that class had existed before as small property owners, but now, large class, and that a conservative force now. Now think about it. Before July 1789, that was a major part of the reservoir of the forces for change. After then, it is, we've had the change, we have got a conservative force. Not indeed an active force, as Marx said about the peasantry. He wasn't very flattering about them. They're like potatoes. To give them a shape, you have to put them in a sack. And but if someone has a sack and he can put the potatoes in it, in other words, he can rally the peasantry, then he can pick it up and hit you on the head very hard with it, and it is then a real force, right? It is not an independent force. Peasantry, Marx argued, now, go along, I think this is absolutely correct, in their very nature are incapable of sustained collective action. Not that they're incapable of collective action for short periods of outbursts, but France 1789 showed that, and a whole series of much earlier events in feudal times, but they're incapable of sustained collective action. So we have then the contradictions of the bourgeois revolution. The problem of the regime is to legitimatize itself in the eyes of people who expected much more, that is to say, the relatively poor urban classes, above all in Paris. And at the same time, right, they've got a peasant base. Did they but know it? They've got a conservative force here, but you have to find that out. And different tendencies, therefore, amongst the bourgeois revolutionaries, read the situation differently at various stages, how to do it, how to control the sans-culottes, Parisian artisans, and so on and so forth. And so there were a series of splits and conflicts. It's from this period, incidentally, that Marx, I think about it, I hadn't thought of this before, but actually it strikes me with the force of a blinding light. Maybe it won't strike you that way. But you know the famous passage where Marx writes about men make their own history and so on, and then he goes on, consciously indeed, that is to say they're not drunk or asleep, but with a kind of false consciousness. That is to say, they are acting in response to circumstances which not only do they not understand, they don't understand the motors, the motive springs of their own actions. Okay, so let's run through then the course of events. The one tendency amongst the bourgeois revolutionaries thought that the solution was a foreign war. Basically, you've got the problem of stabilising the regime, you've got the problem of re-establishment of, in effect, an authoritarian system with parliamentary trappings, because that's what they had, 1790 and so on. A foreign enemy. We can unite everyone around a foreign enemy. This was the policy of the Girondists and some others who were dominant, 1791-92, and sure enough, they got their foreign war. They provoked, maybe they've got it anyway, but they provoked a foreign war. Oh, the invasion of what's then Austrian territory, Belgium, the taking up of the issue of these emigres, who I say are not terribly important, ultimatums, expel them all, you know, the armies of the Republic, well, it wasn't the Republic then, the armies of France will out and so on. They got their foreign war. They hoped that the result of a foreign war would be to consolidate the population around the regime, you know? France, we are French, you know, all French together, and as against the foreigner. They miscalculated. They miscalculated rather seriously. They miscalculated for a number of reasons, the most important of which, however, was that, consciously indeed, but with a kind of false consciousness, they grossly underestimated the seriousness of the opposition, the external, the opposition of the other ruling classes in Europe to their rule. And consequently, they found themselves, by 1793, in a state of crisis. Foreign armies were invading France. You know, they had got by this time all the major powers. They'd managed to get into a war with all the major powers and a whole string of minor ones as well. Yeah, it's quite an achievement in short order. military balance absolutely hopelessly against them. Now then, under these circumstances, the most consistent bourgeois revolutionists, the most clear-thinking and determined of them, saw that in reality, we cannot save the situation. We'll have the old regime back unless there is a profound radicalization of the whole population. And hence, national convention, universal suffrage for men, not women, nobody had thought of that, but universal suffrage, that they never even thought of conceding before. The splendid democratic constitution. Except, and another contradiction, because although the most consistent revolutionaries and the most determined, also bourgeois revolutionaries, there's problems with universal suffrage. They may not vote the way you want them to vote. We've got to allow them to vote and so on, but then we'll have something else. We have the Committee of Public Safety and so on. In other words, we have a group of clear-sighted, this is how they saw themselves, clear-sighted, determined, capable people who will actually direct the process, who will actually guide. But the measures are fairly radical. Measures in economic terms of economic control, control over the economy. Quite contrary, by the way, to the formal beliefs, the formal economic beliefs of all the bourgeois revolutionaries in France, in effect a war economy. But the war economy forced on them. But given a war economy, it can be given egalitarian, whatever you want to say the word, trappings, you know, equality of sacrifice, universal conscription, two people, the rich got out of it, but never mind, the control of the economy, law of the maximum, so on and so forth, a whole series of measures of this sort, and above all, on this basis, the creation of a mass army, drawn largely from the peasantry, which, as I say, was basically a conservative force, but they were not the directors. The Jacobins were the directors. They were the people who determined the shape of the potatoes, because they were the people who determined the sack, right? With this, they saved the regime. They saved the regime. It's really spectacular. You know, Carnot, the 14 armies of the Republic, it's all very exciting, but I mustn't go on about it, because we are still talking about, you know, what Marx took for granted. Now then, that regime was very, very much a minority regime. It was not called the Reign of Terror for nothing. It's true that many atrocities committed by their opponents and so on, far more than by the revolutionaries. That's not the point. It was a reign of terror in the literal sense that the population had been enthused and was now being dragooned and organised by a small group with a quite narrow social base. That's possible at a time of great crisis. What's fatal to it is success. Success. The foreign armies rolled back. The British are kicked out of Marseille. The Austrians rolled back across the Rhine, and so on and so forth. The various émigré and internal insurrectionary units are crushed, and the population is terrorised. But once, of course, the external threat's gone, the revulsion. The revulsion, forget the population for the moment, the revulsion actually amongst the supporters of the Jacobins themselves. Now here we must differentiate a little. The measures of the terror, by the Reign of Terror, by and large, improved the situation of the urban poor.
They were not primarily designed to do so,
but they did.
And so, amongst the mass of the population, we've talked only about Paris, it's essentially important, where the government was. Actually, for the mass of the population, the urban poor in Paris, the regime was a popular one. One thing it did, of course, was pay them to attend section meetings. You know, direct democracy, you've got to come along to vote. But actually, of course, and again, you know the argument, working men can't come unless you know, because they've missed the wages so good. So we have as many meetings as we like and we draw the pay. The model of the reign of terror is the guillotine and heads rolling in the basket. All that's true, but there's the other side to it. With that group, it was popular. The peasantry, it was not popular. And with the middle classes, the bourgeoisie, it would become highly unpopular. Hence, it was overthrown. And again, so, you know, if the social movement is sufficiently profound, the element of actual force necessary to overthrow a regime that has really outlived its day is very small. 9th of Thermidor, they changed the calendar. Very good idea. I think we ought to do it actually after the revolution. I think the Russians were a bit remiss in not taking this up idea. They said, come on, Christianity, superstition, all sorts of pagan rubbish, what have you. No, we'll have a nice new calendar. 12 months? No, 10 months. Right, let's be rational. Decimal system, they introduced, you know, the metric system, all the rest of it later on. So, Thermidor, they don't correspond to our months, obviously. The 9th of Thermidor is the 27th of July. Then Robespierre and his associates and the Committee of Public Safety were overthrown. The actual process of changing the regime was more drawn out than that. They were executed next day. Stone dead hath no fellow. Their ex-allies were very much afraid of them. But, you see, the actual thing, the Committee of Public Safety didn't disappear, it just got a new composition and so on. In fact, however, what appeared on the face of it to be the overthrow simply of one faction by another was a profound social change. It marked the period, the end of the period, in which one tendency of the bourgeoisie, and an important tendency, was radical and wished to push the revolution further, and marked the decisive shift to the right, to social conservatism, on a bourgeois basis, not on a feudal basis, of course, on a bourgeois basis, in retrospect, very, very clear. I mean, in retrospect, a year or two later, not 200 years or what have you later. Now, Thermidor then, Marxist currency, Lenin, Trotsky and so on, all use the term, meaning a profound reaction after a successful revolution. That regime in turn, the regime that ultimately became the regime of the Directory, rested on too narrow a base. That is to say, it lacked the ability at the end of the day to get the united confidence of the bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie had not actually developed to the point that it was capable of collective rule. On the other hand, you've got the urban poor who've been put down. After Thermidor, the reaction. After Thermidor, no more section meetings. That's not literally true. I mean, that was put an end to very, very quickly. After Thermidor, attempted insurrections in Paris. Don't want to discuss them in detail. Put down. The whole shift to the right. But the regime is still too narrow, and the bourgeoisie not capable of rule, and hence we get Bonaparte, the 18th Brumaire, a general, overthrows the government. And again, it fell like a rotten apple. Nobody effectively rose to support the Directory. And what is substituted is apparently the rule of one man. Now, this is again important in terms of the way Marx uses terms. He called this phenomenon Bonapartism after the first Bonaparte, the big one, and he described it as a regime in which it is a class society. Normally we say the government, the state machine, but also the people at the head of it, the government, reflect the interests of the economically dominant class. That's the ABC Marxism, isn't it? According to Marx. Marx also saw you have circumstances in which this is not actually so. In which, because the class forces are, so to say, deadlocked, in which no
class is actually capable of enforcing its collective rule, you get a situation where there has to be a substitute, the man on horseback, etc., who appears to be immensely powerful, and indeed in an individual sense is immensely powerful. It is not at all wise to leave him angry, he'll have your head off. But in social terms, actually owes his power to the deadlock situation, and therefore inherently at the end of the day unstable, because once the bourgeoisie does develop sufficient collective ability to rule, the Bonapartist regime's days are numbered. Or on the other hand, if the oppressed, one or other of the oppressed classes is able to do this, then again the regime is deadlocked. A digression. Trotsky thought of the Stalinist regime in Russia from in the 30s, we'll say, as Bonapartist in this sense. He thought that Stalin looks very powerful, is very powerful in an individual sense, but in truth his independent social base is scarcely exists. It is merely certain sections of the bureaucracy. Why is he immensely powerful? Because on the one hand, and this is a bit of mysticism on Trotsky's part, I thought, I don't know if you attended that debate last night, some people may have done. It really won't do. You see, he talks about his great historical forces. On the one hand, there are the forces of capitalist restoration, meaning private property, the gulags and so on, which, to tell you the truth, by 1930 was a nonsense. And on the other hand, you have the resurgent working class, which also, unfortunately, was a nonsense, because the working class was being atomised, politically atomised and so on. But the way he saw it, you've got these two forces, and they are big and powerful, and this does not weigh very much, you see. This, as long as the two big forces are more or less deadlocked, this thing sits on top. As soon as one or the other, over you go. Bonapartism, that's where the ideas come from, yeah? That's Marx's analysis of it. And that's all we need to say. That is all we need to say about the terminology, right? The direct effect of Marx's assumptions that you all know about the French Revolution, because everyone I ever talk to knows about the French Revolution, because I was born in 1818 and I was born in the Rhineland. Yep. Except for one thing, and the one thing takes us to a second substantial point that I hope to make. I'm only making two. That was, I think there are two are important directly, and that is what happened to the Jacobin tradition. Now, the vast majority of the people who had taken part in the Jacobin regime, the terrorists, as they were called, finished up as cabinet ministers, generals, field marshals, judges, etc., and as they got older, they got more and more and more conservative and indistinguishable from the general bourgeois regime. The members of the Directory, that is the regime which emerged, not immediately, but after a certain interval, from the overthrow of the Committee of Public Safety, the revolutionary regime, the members of it were, without exception, former terrorists themselves. They were all Jacobins. Yep, so there was the transformation, virtually the whole lot of them. But there was also what we might call semi-proletarian or artisan Jacobinism. That is to say, the popular Jacobinism of the Paris artisans. We'll call them artisans rather than workers. It's a rather confused situation, the urban poor. From them, there emerged people working amongst them a tradition. In 1796, an attempt was made to overthrow the regime by, they called it a conspiracy. Body called the Conspiracy of the Equals, at least that's what it became called in retrospect. A body of Jacobins who were not the establishment Jacobins, not reflecting any tendency amongst the bourgeoisie, amongst the middle classes as they now were, not any. They had done once, but not anymore. But the bourgeoisie had still the problem that they had to get rid of the monarchy, absolute monarchy, the decayed relics of feudalism which stood in their path. They needed mass support, and mass support includes also, therefore, the question of the peasantry. Therefore, it is a paradox that the English bourgeois revolution, which in many ways was incomplete, they didn't establish a republic, they established a sort of half republic, they didn't do a whole number of things, okay? And yet, in economic terms, it was very thoroughgoing, whereas the classic model bourgeois democratic republic actually established a large class of conservative peasant landowners, a class which, although of course its specific economic weight is now vastly, vastly smaller, still exists. Right? So the apparent contradiction is due to the different circumstances in which the bourgeoisies found themselves. I mean, their thinking representatives who were able to convince the others, to influence the others, right? The different situations in which they found themselves, and the key question in each case is which class holds power. Now, does that or does that not answer the question? I mean, if it doesn't, or it answers the wrong question, come back. No?
Well, kind of. I just wondered if there was a difference between peasant organisation
or... No. There wasn't any peasant organisation in... Well, I say there wasn't any peasant organisation. What happened in the late summer of 89, you know, the great fear is that groups of peasants started burning chateaux, and I've actually found this rather hard to believe in practice, because I've seen some of these damn chateaux that survived, and they all seem to be built of brick and stone. They're rather difficult to burn. But anyway, so you can believe, and certainly seizing, they had shrewd instinct in one respect, seizing all the legal documents and burning them, the land titles, the titles of the upper layer of the landowners and so on. The countryside was revolutionized, but not by organization, by a spontaneous type of revolt without organization. If it had not coincided with the urban crisis, of course, with the overthrow of the government in Paris, that revolt, like umpteen predecessors in France, in various countries in the Middle Ages, including England, would have been put down. But the two things coincided, so you didn't need organisation. You didn't need organisation, and the peasantry is very, very difficult to organise indeed, because at the same time, the general crisis of the regime precipitated July the 14th, the taking of the Bastille, the collapse, the utter collapse of the state machine, of the monarchist state machine.